Senate Finance Committee will come to order. Today is February 8th, 2011. We have before us Senate File 48, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate File 48 is the DNR lands bill that was put before the legislature last year, a very non-controversial lands bill that allowed the DNR to sell some lands to make up the for the property valuations that had receded somewhat during this last economy. This allows the DNR to sell the lands at up to 75% of the value instead of full value so that they can expedite the sales of those parcels. And it does adjust a few of the boundaries on a couple of the state parks.
Thank you, Senator. I don't have anyone listed to testify. Is there anyone interested in speaking to this bill? Members, are there any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, thank you. This was an issue that was kind of kicked down the the road last year in terms of dealing with the heavy burden that was placed on DNR in relation to meeting what was a general fund solution from several biennia ago. And I think that with this change, they probably could sell even just one parcel of land that would solve that and get it behind us, because we now have several million dollars being carried as if we're going to have that income in our forecasts, and then it shows up that we, you know, didn't. We've been playing that game for several biennia, and so hopefully this will break the logjam and we can get on with it. It drives other behaviors and actions that weren't exactly acceptable, and I was right in the midst of that in the last session. So.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Carlson.
And Senator Olson, thank you for reminding me of that. The immediate nature of the bill is to get the land so that the DNR can get these parcels posted as soon as possible, give a 60-day notice so that they can get these lands posted as soon as possible and get them sold.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
If I might add to it, it's only lands that can be sold and the proceeds going into the general fund. There are much of the lands that are protected based on the part of our recreational system, and those are not lands that can be sold and go into the general fund if they've been purchased with other funds.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Yep. Senator Cohen.
Yep, Mr. Chairman, and thanks, Senator Olson. You didn't say what I was going to say, but I would have asked the question. I don't want Senator Carlson because he wasn't here last year, but maybe Mr. Knopf could just answer whether or not there's anything different in this bill from what we did or attempted to do last year.
Mr. Chair, I was going to say I could answer the question because I attempted to repeal and deal with that requirement on DNR, which would have essentially affected the bottom line because it would have repealed that obligation, and so therefore there would have been a cost, and that's I think why it was delayed, with the effort of trying to at least ultimately find a solution to get to it. But I think Mr. Knopf can amplify on that.
Well, Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, the provision on this, the 75, allowing them to go to 75% of the value or the appraised value, that was in last year's bill that passed the Senate and passed the House, actually vetoed by the governor in the final version. There are only a couple of differences. There are a couple of provisions that were taken care of between the DNR and the parties during the interim. One in Senator Olson's area and then one in Senator Scoy's area. Those are not in the bill, but other than that, as I understand it, this bill is basically the same as what passed last year. And this was not part of the controversy that caused that bill to be vetoed.
But Mr. Chairman, now I recall that this, I know we had passed it out of the Senate, but I'd forgotten that the governor had vetoed the bill. So this basically sends a variation of the same bill to Governor Dayton.
Mr. Knopf?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, only the lands part, the game and fish part was also included last year, and that was where the controversy was.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move Senate File 48 to pass to the floor.
Senator Newman has moved that Senate File 48 be recommended to pass. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of Senator Newman's motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, say no. The motion prevails. The bill is passed.
Thank you, Chairman, and members of the committee.
Thank you, Senator Carlson. Next on the agenda, we have Senate File 42, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Senate File 42 has had some legs, really not uncommon to a lot of bills that go through through our process here. Before going any further, I guess I do have an amendment that I'd like to offer to get the bill in order. I think it's being passed out.
Okay. When we see that, Senator Ingebrigtsen, we'll get the number on that. Senator Ingebrigtsen moves the A-13 amendment. You want to speak to that?
Yes, and with me today I have fiscal analysts as well as Mr. Knopf, if they would come forward to assist me with this. But in general, what it is, over the past 2-3 weeks, we've been dealing with this bill in committees, and I know this isn't the committee to get into any policy, but in general, it has taken a different complexion, as we say, going through the process here, and some of the folks that wanted parts of this to add parts to this bill that we thought were pretty straightforward and we were going to move forward with it. However, we found out that it might be somewhat troublesome. A little bit, if I can back up here. This is the permitting bill that everybody was talking about early on, and I think the House passed it early on. I think it was probably even their House File number one. I'm not sure. But what precipitated this was the incoming governor's talking about and working with the legislature to hurry up the permitting process through the Minnesota PCA as well as the DNR when it comes to permitting for businesses. The chamber became very active and came up with some proposals, which basically some of those, at least the part of those proposals, came out in the governor's executive order after a meeting that we had with House leadership, Senate leadership, and the two new commissioners, Commissioner Landwehr and Ozen, and the governor's office. At that time, we assured him that was absolutely a step in the right direction, and that we appreciated that. However, we thought it was important to put into law, and that's what we did. So on the House side, that went forward with those proposals. Basically, our proposals was the same until we went to committee. We added actually some feedlot issues, a couple of feedlot issues that became somewhat controversial. And I think the amendment addresses that. Those will be taken out, and maybe I could have Mr. Knopf go through the amendment. And everybody has a copy of the amendment, is that correct?
The amendment has been handed out. Mr. Knopf?
Mr. Chairman, it's the A-13 amendment, excuse me. What this would do is...
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, we have the engrossment. Does this fit the engrossment? Because the first line, deleting lines 10 and 11, deletes the title. Is that intended?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Senator Knopf. Olson, it deletes the Article 1 permitting title.
Yes?
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, you'll see later on, Article 2 is being deleted in whole, so there will only be one article.
Okay, thank you.
And so, Mr. Chairman, as I just described the first line of the amendment, the second two lines are basically, you have a paragraph D that's in two sections. You have two sections that are identical, one's for, except almost identical, one's for DNR and one's for Pollution Control Agency. on dealing with permitting and timeliness of permitting. Within those sections is a paragraph that deals with within 30 days of the application that the agency has to send to the permit proposer information about whether the application is complete. And so what this does is that you'll see in the fiscal note the agency is saying that they need 7.8 people to do this, even though I think that the chair would probably dispute the extent of the fiscal note, because it's 7.8 people to review these permits, which they'll have to review at some point, but to do it within the first 30 days, and then to get back a letter telling them whether it's complete or not and what's missing. And so what this does on lines 1.3 and 1.4 of the amendment is it pushes it off to July 1st, 2011. You'll see later on this bill is effective the day following final enactment. So this would make sure that there wouldn't be any additional cost in the current fiscal year, and would just delay this out to the next biennium, so that as part of the ongoing discussions with the agency over the budget for this next biennium, this could be worked out. So that you'll see that in both places where it occurs. And then on lines 1.5, 1.6 of the amendment, this deletes the feedlot provision that Senator Ingebrigtsen mentioned. And then on 1.7 of the amendment, this deletes Article 2. That's the TMDL alternatives. Those provisions are under discussion right now with the agencies and the federal government over how and what best way to go forward with that option. So that's Mr. Chairman, that's the amendment.
Senator Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Knopf, I'm looking at the this fiscal note here. Could you tell me where these FTEs are located in this fiscal note?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Magnus, I think the best place to look would be on page 12.
And Mr.
Table on page 12.
Senator Magnus.
And Mr. Chairman, what I understood you saying from the fiscal note was that Pollution Control is estimating they're going to need how many FTEs to analyze these permits?
Mr. Knopf.
Chairman, Senator Magnus, if you look on, there's an Article 1 permitting, the second line after that, it says 30-day written response to permits.
Right.
You see 7.8 FTEs to do that. And it's my understanding from the agency that they have 80 FTEs currently to review permits.
Well,
Senator Magnus.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Knopf, that's the question I have. If they have these FTEs now, how come they're estimating almost a 10% increase just because the language in the bill stipulated a 30-day review? And I'm questioning just how many permits they're going to additional permits they're going to look at. Maybe Pollution Control is here, Mr. Chairman. Explain this.
Certainly, yes. Come to the microphone. Please identify yourself for the record.
Morning, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Jeff Smith. I'm the director of the Industrial Division at the MPCA. To understand this question, there's actually two pieces that are important to understand. One is that the 30-day notice right now we've got about 15,000 permits that we're in charge of, and we receive about 4,100 to 5,000 applications every year. Right now, we're estimating about 70 to 75% of those applications are incomplete, and incomplete means that under the definition of the bill means that we are unable to begin processing them. The other part that's important to understand is that in conjunction with the 150-day goal, which for us is not so much a goal as a requirement, we'll try and operate our systems to manage to that number. It forces us to amend the way we review applications. Presently, as applications come in, we will accept them as substandard, and we'll begin working on them with the project proposer until they can be completed. And that means it's conversation, it's simple phone calls, we'll meet with them as we're working on other deals. It's not a formal process. It's one that I think has served us well for most of our applications. And by the end of the, you know, a period of time, a few months, we usually have the issues of noncompliance with the application figured out. These two things together, and for us, and because there's no setting of sort of the scale of applications, we're not working on construction. This is all of our applications, so all 4,100 applications. It forces us, one, to be more restrictive on what we'll take as complete. And in our estimation, that will require us to be a little more rigorous on sending applications back. And so we'll go through the review process. We'll, under the language of the bill, we'll tell the project proposer what's incomplete about those applications. We'll send those back, and then they will resubmit an application, which will require us to re-review that application, which contained information from the previous application as well. This could go on two, three, four times based on our experience with the kind of projects that we receive. So the time that's spent here is a function of the number of applications that we're reviewing, 4,000 to 5,000, along with the fact that we've amended our process and we'll be re-reviewing applications every time to make sure that they get to a level that we can accept and call complete so that we may begin working on them.
Senator Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, as I understood your numbers, you quoted Mr. Smith for 15,000 now, and you do how many come up in a year?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we review about, right now our average is about 4,100, but we get up to 5,000 applications a year.
And Mr. Chairman, you said 75% of those are incomplete?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's correct.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Smith, how many additional permits would be required under this Article 2 here we're proposing to delete?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Senator, how many additional, let me understand your question, how many additional permits will we be receiving every year?
No.
Well, Mr. Chairman, as I understand it, your numbers, you're reviewing about 4,100 per year now. Mm-hmm. How many additional permits are the, because I understand you're adding about 10% more people. How many additional permits would be required under the Article 2 that we're deleting?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't think there's any permits that will be deleted. We're just delaying. These permits come up for issuance every 5 years. So these are permits to modify sometimes. These are permits, their applicability determinations, their beneficial reuse determinations. All these pieces fall into the realm of applications. Sometimes they result in new permits. Sometimes they result in the reissuance or modification of existing permits.
Senator Magus?
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Magus, I think Mr. Smith has some clarification. Okay.
Yes, I apologize, Mr. Chair, Senator. I was confused. That's the TMDL language, and there is no permits associated with that particular article.
Oh, okay.
Well, Senator Magnus.
Now I am really confused, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to figure out why we need 10% more people here and why we've got a huge fiscal note on something that I can't figure out what in the world's going on here. And Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Chair,
Senator Gabrielson.
For a point of clarification, the TMDL was an amendment that was put on actually by Senator Scoy, Senator Scoy's request, and that's being removed because the there's been some conversations between the MPCA and him with regards to working out that process and making it a better process. So we thought that would be beneficial to everybody if we were to pull that out and work with that. So that part is being taken out.
Okay.
I'm sorry I didn't explain that to you earlier.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Smith, could I get a little more explanation on I understand your numbers that 75% of those are incomplete, and you're trying to reach this goal here of time to get these permits out. But you also said that you're going to enforce more restrictions on what really complete means. Could you explain that to me,
Mr. Smith?
Mr. Chair, Senator, right now for the most complicated permits, for many of our permits and applications that we receive, the fact that they are necessarily incomplete does not mean that we don't accept them. Our process has been an application comes into the agency, and we will check it to make sure that it's been signed, some of the basics it's been signed, that they've paid the application fee if there is one, that the necessary kind of beginning information is completed on the application. And then we will log into the system and begin working with the project proposer to make that thing, to make that application at a point where we can call it complete enough for us to begin working on it. That's the goal of the legislation. That is also our goal as an agency. Unfortunately, the part that gets is complicated by the 30-day requirement is that we're forced to do that much more rigorously than we have in the past. Our process has been that, again, that I will, that my staff will contact the project proposer when we pick up the application for the first time, which might be a few weeks to a few months, depending on whether it's a high-priority construction permit or just a reissuance. And then we will begin the process of asking questions, exchanging information, a much more informal process so that we can come to the point where we've got enough information to call the application complete. The difference under this, the proposal here, is that we'll have to complete that review within 30 days, and it must be a much more rigorous process. In other words, we'll have to review the application, and then send back a formal comment letter, which are often 6, 8, 10 pages of information. And then the project proposal will get that comment letter. They're going to take time to respond. They'll resubmit an application, and the process begins over again. So the place where this takes additional time is that conversation, which in the past has been a much more informal process to collect information, now is much more formal. We expect to be repeating that a few times for the most complicated permits.
Well, just one final comment now, Mr. Chairman, and I, you know, when I heard you say that, I'm very concerned about this because, you know, what the Federals did when they reformed the financial laws after the Wall Street bailout has caused us significant nightmares. And, for example, I talked to one of the huge home mortgage finance companies here in the state, one of the huge banks here. And they said that they have 167 pages of regulations now. They said that even if you put a page out of sequence in your loan application, it'll cause them to toss it on the floor, and you're out. And, Mr. Chairman, you don't even get a chance to reapply. So just a simple thing like that can throw it all out of whack, a page out of sequence, and your loan is declined. And so I'm very worried about, you know, the sort of restrictions that we're going to put in place here. Mr. Chairman, most of us feel we've got to hang the open for a business sign back up in the state. And I think that's the goal of all of us. I hope it's the goal of the agency because we're in a lot of competition. Every state out there except for North Dakota is struggling for funding. Every state out there is struggling for jobs. I hear the radio ads constantly from Sioux Falls to come down there. They're open for business. Their politicians understand business, and they're directing those comments at us, to Chairman. So I'm very concerned about what actually does happen with these regulations, and I understand you're trying to meet the time frame, and I support that. But you have to look at new innovative ways of speeding this process along.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Magnus and members, I don't think there's anybody at this table that doesn't agree with you that the process has to be dealt with a little bit in a little more of a timely fashion. I think that's what we're hearing. And those types of horror stories when you have one thing out of sequence and all of a sudden you got to start all over with, that's just unacceptable, I think, and I think we agree with that. But I think what's happened here is I think the two agencies have realized that something, you know, somebody's paying attention, something has to be done. already with Senator Scoy's amendment. We've got a working relationship going there, so we're getting here working that direction. I'm committed to working with and looking further into the amount of folks that have to be hired here, quite frankly. We're a little surprised as to how many had to be done as well. So, but we're not talking about general fund dollars. I think that's important to understand here. This is environmental dollars, that can be worked in my budget later on here in the session. But the savings we're going to show, of course, are going to be from fiscal note shows about a $34,000 savings from the DNR, as well as the courts, about a $12,000 savings in the courts. And it doesn't seem like much, Mr. Chair, when it comes to the courts, but you're also not figuring in, obviously we can't figure that in, the personal costs of not having to stop at that one court proceeding, go directly to the Court of Appeals. So it's a work in progress. We're gonna continue. I think folks around the table here and myself for sure is committed to making this a better system, and again, keeping in mind the environment, and we have to do that.
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm very concerned by the comments that I've heard this morning. I agree with the direction of Senator Magnus's comments, and I'd like to go back to some of the comments, Mr. Smith, you made with regard to how to reflect the intent of this legislation that you and your staff would be handling these permits. And I think if we look at the intent of, for example, the executive order, the intent of the executive order to streamline the process was so that business could move through this process more quickly and more competitively. So the notion that if there were some things that were incomplete, the answer would be to just send it back and say reapply, and you'd write this long thing, and then they'd have to reapply, to me is completely inconsistent with the intent of the executive order and the intent of what should be this legislation. I would hope that you would direct your staff to contact who's ever applying and work in the same informal and cooperative fashion that you did before, and perhaps just do that in a much more streamlined and quick fashion. Rather than look at adding seven personnel, I might ask whether you've considered contacting the Department of Administration, where they have gone to various departments around the state and implemented lean processes, and they've explored other methods. I think that is what we should all be looking at. How can we transform the culture in which we're operating so that we actually increase our effectiveness, and rather than if we then have a higher standard, the answer can't just be more people. So I'm concerned about the fiscal note. I'm concerned that we might, in fact, provide a lower quality experience to those who are going to be interacting with the state. I don't think we want that. I think we want our citizens, every time they interact with the state, to experience quick turnaround and, you know, customer service.
Senator Perry, and then Mr. Smith, I think you want to respond to some of this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Smith, I think what has struck me interesting was your statement that you expect the permits to come in substandard. And that leads me to believe that maybe you need to look within. Maybe what you're asking is so out of the realm of a person understanding that maybe it just boggles my mind that you would say that you expect them to come in substandard, that you wouldn't look at maybe changing the way you ask whatever it is you're asking of these applicants to make it easier for them to get to the point where you want them to go, which would lead to Senator Bonoff's, you know, streamlining quicker and getting the application back.
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Senators, very good points, and let me respond first to the idea of process improvement. The agency has been a state leader. In fact, we're the hosts of many training events in terms of process improvement tools about 8 years ago, 9 years ago, with a previous commissioner who came from the private side. She was the implementer of the Six Sigma process with the agency. Since that time, I think, and I'd be happy to come back and present all the process improvement efforts that we've gone through as an agency using all the business tools that are available, Six Sigma, Lean, Kaizen. We are well-versed in all those things, and we have done dozens, if not hundreds, of projects throughout the agency in terms of process improvement. So this has been a key part of the reason why our overall permit time, our backlogs have dropped from, on the water side, 40% down to about 10%, as well as our average time to issue permits from 260 days as an agency across all the media programs in 5 years ago, 2005, to about 70 days currently. So we are actually been doing a great job, I think, in terms of process improvement and making the agency and the experiences that people have with us much better. One thing I think that's important to understand is also that the application process is driven by the federal process. The agency does not make up our own application process. The rules that govern the agency's permitting activities, air, water, and land, are all primarily driven by federal processes, Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, and the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. We do not make up the standards by which applications are submitted. Those are federal pieces, although we have tried over the years and have been very successful in making the process more streamlined. I think I'll have one more comment, if I may.
Yeah, absolutely.
The problem with this particular bill, the challenge for us, is that we're dealing with 4,100 to 5,000 applications. And in my estimation, trying to take all that in one bite is unnecessary. For the most part, our informal processes that deal with general applications for general permits, which are very fast, a couple of days to a couple of weeks typically for us to get general permits out, which cover most of our applications, that process takes care of itself, and it's not something that this committee or legislators in general hear about. The thing that is most important to you, and I support your, our goals of trying to get and support business in a much more efficient way, we can do that if we were to focus our efforts and our authorities here to amend legislation on construction permits. The problem is we are trying to fix a problem where there is not a problem for most of the applications. If we were to focus on the 200 construction permits versus 15,000 permits, we could do exactly what you're asking us to do without having to do all the reporting, all the feedback that most of the permittees do not care about. They don't care about getting a response back to the application within 30 days if it's a reissuance of an existing permit or it's a general permit where they'll get their permit within 30 days. So my proposal, and I proposed this to folks at the House and the Senate, was to think about the language in terms of construction permits. We've got a definition, and we'd be prepared to talk about the benefits of that if the time's appropriate.
Mr. Smith, could you?
Mr. Chair, follow on.
Well, just 1 second. Senator Bonoff, staff brought up a good question that I just wanted you to touch on before we go there. What portion of these are merely renewals where the business can continue to operate versus something where business is waiting to expand, waiting to create jobs, or starting up? Could you just break that down for us? And then, Senator Bonoff, your follow-up.
Mr. Chair, sort of how you cut the cards, but in general, I would say 60 or 70% are reissuance permits, including general permits and individual permits. And again, general permits for us, we typically issue within a couple of days to a couple of weeks.
Senator Bonoff, your follow-up.
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Smith, I stand corrected with regard to the process improvement. I appreciate your sharing the work that you've done, and I do think that that's something that I'm hoping all of our agencies will participate in. And I also would encourage you to work with Senator Ingebrigtsen on language so that we are smart about, you know, responding with policy direction in a way that does what we wanted to do without actually adding burden.
Okay, members, I'm going to work my way through the list here. I've got a number of people that have wanted to, I presume, ask some questions or comments. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was following up on Senator DePerry's comment. The talk has been about process, but your description of the review of the permit and the response letter and itemizing all of these things would lead me to believe in your expectation that there will be incomplete applications says something about how the application form or the instructions for it are written. It never ceases to amaze me how government kinds of programs and the lingo that's used can give you an absolute headache trying to figure out what precisely is needed. And I don't know what kind of review you do look at or if that is dictated by the federal government to have to use their language to. But somewhere in state government, there should be somebody that could be able to review these kinds of materials and actually assure that they're in plain, understandable English. Because I think then if it's clear that they know what they need to provide, essentially they can check off and determine whether it might get better applications from the get-go, but also if you are responding in kind with clearly itemizing the areas that are in void, then it seems to me when it would come back for the next round, you're not necessarily having to look at everything. You can focus in on the ones that were deficient or missing, and it shouldn't have to take so much time. But I just wondered if you're looking not just the process, but also the means of communication. Now, yes, the oral communication allows for a lot of clarification, but good writing also helps. And you can probably tell I come from education, and we hear this constantly. In fact, I was kind of interested in our demographer's response to a comment or question from Senator Bonhoeff the other day in our joint tax and finance committee, when talking about dealing with other countries about need for foreign language, and his response was, a lot of the people that are in this would really be happy if people were good at one language, and I think that is one of our challenges today is that a real clear use of the English language so that people can understand. It's a burden on education, but it affects everybody. So I just lay that challenge to you too, and maybe I'm misjudging, but I suspect that there is probably room for improvement in that part of the process.
Senator Newman,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment for Mr. Smith. When I think of agency law, I think in terms of certain criteria. Having been laid out and once met, then the agency is obligated to act accordingly. And from what I hear from your explanation, it sounds to me like there's much too much subjective interpretation of what's going on in the permitting process. And when I hear a figure of 75% of the applications that come in are incomplete, I would take that as almost an admission of failure. There has to be something wrong within your entire process. If we have got 75% of the applications coming back that are not acceptable, and I would just simply urge you to take another look at what you're doing within your agency, because that to me is an unacceptable figure.
Senator Anderson, did you?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I had a couple of questions. One is, looking at the fiscal note, the first thing that really jumped out at me is on page 3, and if you look at the assumptions, and this is for the DNR staffing, it says staff involved in processing permits would need to spend additional time documenting and summarizing information in order to provide the data required by these reports. The need to spend time compiling and providing data for the reports would result in a slightly longer response time for all permits, because the total time the FTEs dedicated to permit-related work would likely remain the same. That's in the Ecological and Water Resources Division, and then the exact or similar language is under Lands and Minerals Division. And it says, again, that staff is going to have to spend a bunch of extra time doing this paperwork and documenting all the information that's required by this law in order to meet the bureaucratic rules that are in this bill. And it seems to me, I thought the purpose of this bill was to make permitting faster, not slower. And according to the fiscal note, it's actually going to make permitting slower because you're putting so many record-keeping and documentation and paper-shuffling requirements on our agency staff. So why do we want to do that, Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Well, we certainly don't want to make it slower, Senator Anderson. Thank you for that question. And I think you've probably heard me say that this is certainly a work in progress, working also with the governor's office in a bipartisan fashion, and I'm certainly willing to step up and do that. Now, it is somewhat confusing, I would say, and I think the DNR might be here. They could answer to that as to more work and costing less money. Is that what your question is? I mean, that's what we're here.
Mr. Senator Chair, Anderson? It just says right here that the need to compile all this data and do all these reports that's required in your bill will result in a longer response time for all permits. And I'm not sure if you read this fiscal note before today, but I would be really concerned that that violates the whole intention of this bill. So why would you be putting requirements here that will actually slow down permitting?
I'm not sure if the DNR is here that could answer for this fiscal note. I think he is.
Yes.
If he would come up and explain it a little further.
If you'd come to the table and state your name for the record, please.
However, again, that's not the intention.
Mr. Chairman and Member Steve Hirsch, I'm the Director of the Division of Ecological and Water Resources for DNR. And Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson, the language that you're referring to, we were just basically stating that in order to be able to collect some of the information required by the legislation, that it would require slightly more time on our staff. Emphasis on the word slightly. We do issue most of the permits in DNR that would be affected by this legislation in less than 150 days already. As we gather some of the information on why some permits are taking longer, you know, the hope would be that we would be able, that would help to inform process improvements that we could make in the future. So I wouldn't overemphasize the longer response time there. It is just a slightly longer response time, and we're already issuing most permits within the goals in the legislation. So.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Hirsch. And okay, so it will just slightly delay permitting. What about there's another requirement in here that I think is duplicative that relates to talking about federal law and what the, you know, how the rule would apply, would compare to a federal law requirements. And did you include that requirement in this section where you're talking about additional reporting, or is that an extra requirement beyond what you were commenting on here?
Mr. Hirsch?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson, I'm not sure what you're referring to. Is it if it's about the one area in the bill that we had some concerns with federal requirements had to do with the provisions that allow a project proposer to write the EIS. And the issue there could be that the National Environmental Policy Act, which governs federal environmental review, does not allow that provision. And so In cases where the project proposer was actually writing a state EIS, it would preclude doing a joint state federal EIS. But that, I don't think that was really related to the fiscal note. And I'm not sure if that's what you're referring to.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm trying to find this section. Here we go. What I'm looking at is page 7, paragraph F, where it talks about, and this may apply more to the PCA, but it says the statement of need and reasonableness has to include documentation that the federal standard does not provide adequate protection for public health and the environment, and a comparison of the proposed standard with the standards in border states, et cetera. So that, to me, because there's already a requirement under Chapter 14 about, you know, you have to comment on federal law and how it compares with the state rule, this seems to add, again, to the paperwork and the reporting requirements that are needed under current law.
Well, before we go there, Senator Olson, to this point.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson. I appreciate your questions on this. Mr. Hirsch, how do we now know how long it's taking? Do you keep some records of how long applications take? And is that reported to us in some fashion now?
Mr. Hirsch, maybe you can address both of these, sir.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, we don't keep specific records, but we just know And that would be one of the benefits of starting to collect some of this information so that we had actually more quantitative information. But most of the permits that we deal with we just know they have time frames that are less than 150 days. I think for the water permits, I believe there's a overall 60-day time frame. Aquatic plant management permits, our time frame, if it's just a renewal, turnaround is often less than a couple of weeks. So it's qualitative, it's not quantitative. And Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson, I believe the question that Senator Anderson asked pertained more to PCA. So.
Mr. Smith?
Mr. Chair, Senator.
Actually, Mr. Smith, before you do that, Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would like an answer from the PCA on that, please. But I also, if I could, I wanted to follow up with what Mr. Hirsch was talking about in terms of the project proposer writing the EIS, because so he could elaborate on that answer. I didn't quite get that. Whichever one you want first.
Why don't you go, Mr. Hirsch, and then Mr. Smith, you can follow.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson, some of the large EISs that we've done over the last few years, the mining EISs, which have been very high profile, as you know, have been joint state-federal EISs because there's requirements under both the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA, and the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act, or MEPA. And so there's some efficiencies in doing those together. Our project manager at the state level tends to manage the whole process, and you kind of make sure that you're, killing two birds with one stone, so to speak. In this legislation, if a project proposer was to actually write the EIS according to this legislation, there's no provision in NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, for that to happen. So I don't think, I think it would preclude doing the joint state-federal EIS, and that would mean the federal EIS would go off on its own track, which could tend to be a longer track than when you combine them, believe it or not, even though there tends to be long when you combine them as well. So,
Mr. Chair,
Senator Anderson.
I guess just on that point, I think one of my concerns about this bill also is that, I just don't think as a matter of policy it makes sense to have the project proposer write their own environmental impact statement. That sort of defeats the whole purpose of making sure that there's some oversight over protecting our air and water quality. But what you're saying, Mr. Hirsch, is that could really add duplication and make it the whole process less efficient because we'd have a federal process working separately from the state process. And so it sounds like it would just add perhaps more delays to do that as well, potentially.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I think we're getting a little off of the scope of what my function is here today with regards to the Finance Committee, and I certainly appreciate Senator Anderson's comments. I know this is near and dear to her. She's worked on these issues for years, but we're here today to talk about the fiscal note, and I really do appreciate the conversation, though. it's certainly good to have the PCA here to at least take in your comments, but I think we're getting a little more into the policy part, and that, of course, has been discussed at this point, and we're also going to have a conference committee to deal with that further. So.
Mr. Chair, could I just have Mr. Smith answer that other question? And
sure. Mr. Smith's been waiting so patiently.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator. Yes, that part is almost exclusively based on the PCA's work. We write the rules that cover changes to water quality and air quality standards. So that piece is about taking a look, kind of benchmarking with EPA Region 5, which Minnesota is part of, and also the surrounding states, the Dakotas, Iowa, which is not part of EPA Region 5, to understand what regulations and standards they might have that are applicable to those so we can compare those. And for us, that is going to take a little bit longer. It's a little more work for us. And for us, it was about a quarter of an FTE each year.
So, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm trying to keep this to the fiscal issues and focus on how much additional staff time and sort of, steps that state employees have to go through to meet the requirements of this bill if it were to pass. And so I guess that federal requirement that will add more sort of record keeping and reporting and bureaucratic process to the whole existing law.
Senator Olson, to this?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I guess I would like to just continue that track I'd asked of Mr. Hirsch, but if you could, let's see, I missed the name.
Mr. Smith and Mr.
Smith.
Hirsch.
Oh, a tough name to remember. Sorry.
like Olson.
Yes. I have troubles with that at times, too. So, Mr. Smith, if there's some knowledge of the length of time, there must be something, whether it's electronically or whatever, when applications are that length of time is that it takes to deal with that. I think we're interested here in monitoring how that changes. If you set another deadline, does it develop the action and within the agency to do some of the things that have been going through some of our minds here of how might, whether it's process or communications or what it is that might actually improve that with efficiency. It seems that the cost of adding more people doesn't create efficiency. That adds more economic, burden to the process. And so, therefore, it's likely to become less efficient if you're including cost in that that element. And so, I think from the purview here of adding that much staff to say we're becoming more efficient is going the opposite direction. I think there's got to be ways to make more efficient the way in which these issues are handled within what you have. And then try to determine even with simple measures, I'm not as concerned that all of the reasons or rationale. Maybe that's important if there's some other policy that needs to be changed. But it sounds like in some of these cases, we're required to meet federal standards, and so therefore we don't have much control over that part of it. But can you address that? Because I just have a hard time, too, with the adding seven people in the name of efficiency.
Senator Bonhoff, do you want to piggyback on that?
Yeah, I would. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Ingebretson, you've said, well, this is a work in progress, but this is the Finance Committee. We're getting to the last stop. And so I don't think that we ought to just move the thing along. I think what you're hearing is some real concern about the fiscal note and the way that this is moving forward does not seem consistent with the intent that we all have. And so I'm concerned that we wouldn't just say, oh, well, we'll work it out along the way. I think we ought to have some very high and with regard to it not coming out of the general fund, it's still taxpayer dollars. So it doesn't matter to me whether it's the general fund or just, a different way taxpayers are paying. So I think we ought to get to the bottom of this.
Okay, I've got several names here backed up. Senator Ingebretson wants to respond to
Thank
that.
Thank you. Yes, I agree. However, I just don't think this group wants to go through a whole lot of policy on here with regards to the bill. And I, too, Senator, have an issue with hiring that many FTEs. That's certainly an issue that I, less than 24 hours, received from the fiscal note. And I also am concerned about why it's going to take so many folks.
Okay, members, I have Senator Hand, Cohen, and Goodwin in that order. Maybe going back a bit. Senator Hand, and hopefully we can wrap this up in about 5-10 minutes here.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I hope my question will be briefly responded to. And I want to go back to the original question Senator Magnus was raising with respect to the fiscal note and the additional 7-10% additional people and the cost. And Mr. Smith, going back to your comments that you made, it seemed to me you were saying that the additional people was in response to meeting the constraints of making sure that permits are issued within 150 days and that there's a response to the completeness of the proposal by the proposer within 30 days and that would drive the need for additional people. Can you tell us what the time frame is now? If moving to 150 and 30 is the reason, it would seem to me that we're somewhat greater than that right now. Can you tell us what those numbers are?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Senator, right now we issue between 75 and 80% of all of our permits within 180 days. For the most part, we can meet that 150-day goal for almost all of our permits. And that's been as I mentioned earlier, our goal here is to focus on the permits that are of interest to the business community. the ones that make it to the ears of the legislators, the ones that are important for jobs and growth. Right now, our number one priority in terms of as we receive applications, we work on those construction permits first. Unfortunately, those are also typically the biggest permits. They involve multimedia, working across air, water, and land areas, so they need a number of different permits. They also involve environmental review, typically, which is a separate process. And they also typically pull in a number of the most interested citizens and environmental groups who may either support or contest the permit. So they become the place where a lot of conversations happen through public meetings, and public notices, and contested case hearings and lawsuits. The work that we've done over the last 10 years to reduce our backlog and to close out our permit time have been around those permits that are the simplest to issue, and that's why we talked about process improvement. That's the place where the choices we make as an agency in terms of making better applications, speeding up the process, working with the project proposers earlier, making sure that applications come in that are more thorough. That's a place where the agency has more kind of impact day to day, and that has shown in our ability to issue most of our permits within 150 days. I did present to last session the legislature report that showed our five-year averages for our permitting programs, air, water, and land. And you may recall that report. I think it was distributed in February last year. In that report, you saw a nice trend down across all of our media programs. So as an average, like I said, we're issuing permits in about 70 days. But that's averaging all those permits. And as I said earlier, the ones that are of interest are about 200. And those are the ones that I would propose to you that we focus our process streamlining on and our reporting pieces on for the purposes of not spending additional time working on fixing a problem where the public and you folks do not care because they're reissuances, or we're already very fast with those.
Senator Cohen?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Smith, just a couple quick questions. Your testimony a while ago was that a lot of this began with the Federal Clean Water Act. Is that correct, Mr. Smith? And that's what, 1970? That was what President Nixon's?
1972.
Okay, so every state in the country is dealing with that, so we're not an exception to the rule in that regard. The other question, and a lot of it's been asked, but let me ask it a slightly different way. In terms of the fiscal note suggesting a significant number of additional FTEs needed for implementation of the bill, has there been any layoff or attrition within your agency over these last several years?
Mr. Smith?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, I have. I can't remember the exact numbers, but I think we're down around 80 to 100 FTEs over the last couple of years.
Okay, so Mr. Chairman, Mr. Smith, and this might not be the question for yourself, but if you had not reduced the FTEs within the agency to that extent, would you have kept abreast of the permitting process somewhat better without then requiring additional FTEs with this legislation?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I do not believe that that would have impacted. Certainly would have helped some of the timeliness issues, but the process that we have been following for applications has been the same for a number of years now. And additional staff, had we kept them over the last couple of years, would not have changed that at all because we're focused, like I said, for most of the applications, we're very, very fast getting those permits out. Even though they are incomplete, we work through that over the course of a couple of days, couple of weeks, with the project proposers in a more informal way to get the information so that we're able to issue the permits anyway.
Senator Olson to that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Smith. If you were to change, as you suggest, and narrow the focus of this effort for improving efficiency, to that, a smaller number of projects, more complex ones. How would that, can you make any prediction of how that would change the fiscal note?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Senator, it would reduce the entire application piece if we were to focus the 7.8 FTEs allotted to the application review. That would reduce to zero. We could manage, with current resources, the 200 or so facilities that I'm talking about here.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Smith or Senator Ingebrigtsen, either one of you, how does this proposal differ from what the governor's executive order, what was in the governor's order?
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Senator Goodwin. The governor's executive order, for one, did not include the court appeal process. They couldn't deal with that. That's basically going to district court and from there to appeals court. This bill addresses eliminating the district court piece. So that part we have discussed in judiciary, but that's probably the major portion of the change. I think the goodwill and the intent of the executive order is very reflective in the legislation here. Other than that,
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the other part that was missing from the executive order was the project proposer being able to do their own EIS.
That's right.
That also requires a significant rule change.
That's significant, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
You said, Mr. Smith, that you lost between 80 and 100 staff at your agency in the last 2 years. How many of those were in permitting?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I guess I don't have the exact numbers here. I could definitely track that down and get that to you. It's some proportion of that. It's probably six or eight. But I can definitely try and track down that exact number for you.
Okay, thank you. One more, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name.
Mr. Hirsch.
Mr. Hirsch, I think what you said, and maybe I got it wrong, is that you don't keep quantitative information about when permits come in and when they leave. So that just kind of surprises me, and because I would imagine that would be the supervisor manager that would insist that those numbers be kept, so you could at least know how, where glitches are or problems when you're processing permits. And can you tell me why that isn't the case?
Mr. Hirsch.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Goodwin, I think you raise a good point, and I think it's a need. I would say that the reason we haven't done it is because, for the most part, we're getting those permits out in a timely fashion. But I think as this issue has been raised, it's caused us to look at it and consider the fact that we would be able perhaps to make process improvements down the road if we had more quantitative information about why some percentage of permits take longer. Anecdotally, you know, we could say, yeah, it tends to be for this reason or that reason, but, it's always good to measure it more precisely and collect some more quantitative information.
Thank you.
Members, we've had a long discussion, but I don't believe we have yet actually acted on the A-13 amendment. So Senator Ingebrigtsen moves the A-13 amendment. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A-13 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say no.
No.
Motion prevails. Senator Ingebrigtsen, we now have Senate File 42 as amended before us. Would you like to move that?
I would like to move Senate File 42 as amended, Mr. Chair.
Senator Ingebrigtsen moves that Senate File 42 as amended be recommended to pass. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, say no.
No.
Motion prevails. We now have Senate File 39, if Senator Cruz is available, and Senator Roebling will take the chair.
I'm
wasn't the amendment.
Okay, we have Senate File 39, Senator Cruz, on the Mississippi River Corridor Critical Area Specific Requirements for Rulemaking Elimination.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman and Committee. Essentially, I want to do my best to respect the committee's time and scope, so I'll get to the point here. Senate File 39 is a bill repealing a rulemaking authority that was put in place in 2009 concerning the Mississippi Critical Area Corridor. Essentially, what this does is the rulemaking process that was put in place was not completed by the January 4th deadline that we had before us. So what we're looking to do is repeal that language. The net effect is going to be a $151,000 savings to Minnesotans that will go to the Clean Water Fund. As well as, if you look at your fiscal note there, potentially some pretty significant savings to local municipalities, townships, and counties, estimated to be at a minimum about $50,000 per local unit of government there. So essentially the remaining $151,000 would be made up of $40,000 that would be related to hearing costs, and then an additional $111,000 that was not spent out of the initial $500,000 allotted in the 2009 legislation.
Do members have any questions for Senator Cruz?
Madam Chair.
Senator Cohen.
So what does the bill do?
Well, essentially, as I had mentioned, the bill repeals a 2009 legislation that was put in to direct the DNR to construct a rulemaking process or construct rules regarding the Mississippi Corridor, which is a 72-mile corridor along the Mississippi from Hastings up to about Ramsey. Yeah.
Ma'am Chair, I don't know.
Senator Cohen.
And I've got my southern border is the river. I don't serve on Senator Ingebrigtsen's committee, so I don't know if this was heard in more detail in that committee. But so, Madam Chair, I don't know if this is directed to the author, to Senator Cruz, or to maybe other folks who are here, as to what, and Senator Anderson would be more knowledgeable than I am, certainly, as to what the impact is going to be on the Mississippi River. This is the first I've seen this bill, and so it looks like it's a total repeal of everything we've put into state rulemaking and law relative to protection of the river. And so I'm just wondering what the consequence would be if we pass the bill.
Senator Cruz.
Madam Chairwoman, Senator Cohen, that's not the intent of the bill. That's not the effect of the bill. Essentially, the corridor designation itself will remain in place. This bill strictly repeals the rulemaking authority that was adopted in 2009. Now, this legislation did actually have about a three-hour hearing in Chairman Ingebrigtsen's Environment Committee, significant amounts of testifiers there as well. But to address your concern, Senator Cohen, no, this does not repeal the whole corridor. The corridor is actually protected in multiple different levels, to be honest with you. It does have a national park designation. This is also guarded by shoreline regulation and municipal regulations that all cover those areas of that corridor, as well as the initial executive order that was put into place by Governor Cui, which established the corridor.
Senator Goodwin?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Cruz. Boy, you got a whopper here. There's how many, 37 different environmental groups that are against your very first bill that you get to carry in the Senate. So I'm wondering, I'm not looking at the fiscal note right now, so maybe this question isn't appropriate for this committee, but again, I don't understand the need for this language, why this is important.
Senator Cruz.
Madam Chairwoman, Senator Goodwin, at the risk of overextending the scope of this committee and getting back into what we spoke about in Chairman Ingebrigtsen's Environment Committee, if you would have seen the testimony in that committee, there's some extreme concerns about government overreach, duplication of government. There's a lot of folks, be it from the municipal level, the county level, residents, businesses along that corridor, that are extremely concerned, if enacted, what these rules would do to their homes, to their businesses. And you had mentioned the group of the environmental groups that were against this. I would comment that I can promise you there's equally as many, if not more, concerned residents, businesses, counties, and municipalities.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Cruz, thank you, but I haven't heard from any of those. I've just been heard from those that are opposing it.
Madam Chairwoman and Senator Goodwin.
Senator Cruz.
I was under the impression that in this committee we were strictly going to talk about the fiscal note and the financial impact of this bill. I did not know that we were going to dive back into the policy aspect of this bill. So therefore, we did not have those folks here today intentionally for that reason.
Well, Senator Cruz, we appreciate that you had a three-hour hearing on this in the Environment Committee, and our intention today really is to look at the fiscal impact of the bill. We want members to understand what's in the bill, certainly, mm-hmm. but we are focusing on the dollar amounts.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cohen.
Just on that point, because I think it's important for issues as they come in front of this committee. Obviously, I've been on this committee a long time, and I think, when I was chairman, as you're doing right now, Sarah Miriam before me, we would attempt to certainly focus on fiscal issues, but we never made any attempt, and I'm suggesting you are, but we never made any attempt to cut off discussion and debate relative to the policy considerations that surrounded those fiscal issues so that members on the committee had a full sense of what they were voting on. There's always a fine line, say, between amendments being offered, and I would try to encourage members not to offer amendments that were strictly policy amendments to finance bills, to bills with a fiscal impact in this committee. But we always had a full discussion of the issues surrounding the particular bill.
And Senator Cohen, we're certainly able to discuss what's in the bill today, but I know Senator Cruz was told that he did not have to bring multiple testifiers and repeat everything that happened in the Environment Committee. So that's what we're trying to avoid. Senator Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair, along the same lines, let's see. This is related to Clean Water Legacy funding. And, if Senator Cruz came forward with a bill that would repeal all the spending that we passed in the last 2 years under the Clean Water Legacy Law, then the fiscal note would simply say we just saved $160 million. But I don't think that would be adequate for us to make a decision, because we need to know what are we giving up and what are we losing. I mean, we could repeal lots of funding bills and save a lot of money and be done and go home. And, life would be grand. We would have lots of money in the budget. But what would the impact be on clean water? It seems to me we can't make a decision about spending without knowing what the money is for. And I guess, not serving on the Environment Committee anymore, unfortunately, I wasn't able to hear the testimony either. So I'm very concerned about not knowing what the substantive impact on the Mississippi River is before we choose to vote on this. And so, Madam Chair, I guess the question I would ask for Senator Cruz to sort of start the fiscal discussion is, we appropriated $500,000 for this bill because we decided as a legislature and as the governor who signed this into law that it was critical for the state to protect the water quality of the Mississippi River, and that's what those Clean Water Legacy funds are for. And so where did that $500,000 go, with the exception of what's left that you're calling savings in this fiscal note? $151,000 is unspent, but where did the rest of the $349,000 go? For what purpose, and why do we want to just throw that away?
Senator Cruz.
Madam Chairwoman, Senator Anderson, thank you very much for that question. I really appreciate it, and I'm going to do my best to address that. First, your initial point, what would be the impact? It sounds to me like you're concerned about what the environmental impact of this bill would be. To answer your question, there would be none. The legislation, this does not repeal any legislation guarding the Mississippi River right now. The rules that this 2009 legislation created, or the rules that were drafted based off of that initial $300,000+ that was spent in that process, have not been enacted yet. So policy-wise, the protections that are along that critical area corridor are going to stay in place. All of the protections that we have there today will remain there. This does not change any of that. To answer your question again, as far as where did the rest of the money go, that was utilized up to this point, be it through hearings and different things like that, in the rulemaking creation process. That would not be lost. All those drafted rules would be retained. So the dollars and the research that was spent would not be lost.
Madam Chair Anderson.
Well, okay, I believe that in the repealer, the law that was passed that you're repealing says the Commissioner of Natural Resources may adopt rules that are necessary for the administration of the Mississippi River Corridor Critical Area Program. So if we pass your bill, the DNR will not have that authority to adopt these rules. Am I reading that correctly, that if we pass this bill, these rules will just go in a drawer somewhere and can never be adopted? Under Minnesota law.
Senator Cruz.
Madam Chairwoman, Senator Anderson, they would not be adopted. You are correct in that. I don't know that I would consider that being lost, though. If a future legislature would like to bring those up, I would imagine, just as at any time, they would be more than able to do that. So that would not be lost.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Let me make sure we're clear on this. So, okay, the DNR couldn't promulgate these rules. The rules couldn't go forward unless a future legislature voted and changed the law if we pass your bill, correct?
Senator Cruz.
Madam Chairwoman, Senator Anderson, to my knowledge, I believe you are correct in that, yes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Senator Cruz, you're suggesting that this money doesn't affect the environmental protection of the river because the rules haven't been implemented yet. So are you saying that there's no need to improve the water quality in the Mississippi River and that it's just great the way it is, or that do you believe we should make any improvements in the water quality in the Mississippi River?
Senator Cruz.
Madam Chairwoman, Senator Anderson. Again, I question to the scope of this committee. I guess I kind of wonder if that's within this. To answer your question, what do I think? From all of the testifiers that I have talked to, all of the residents, all of the businesses, all of the counties, all of the cities that have talked to me, I've seen nothing but a progressive betterment of the river. I know that these residents and businesses respect the river. They cherish the river. That's why they purchase properties along the river. And I, from everything that I've seen, they go very long ways in protecting it and caring for it. That's their property. They have significant amount of financial resources that are invested there. And from what I've seen, they're going to do everything they can to protect those investments and protect the river that they love.
Madam Chair, just my last
Senator
question.
Anderson.
I guess I didn't really hear an answer in that statement. I understand why people don't want to change their practices or, if they're property owners along the river. I certainly understand that affects their point of view about what should and shouldn't happen. But the question is, my community, I live in St. Paul, and many of our residents get our drinking water from the Mississippi River. So we're really concerned about making sure that that water is clean. And so that's what I'm thinking about as I vote for your bill. So what I want to know is, do you believe the Mississippi River is clean enough, or do you think we should improve the water quality in the Mississippi River? That seems to be a fundamental question before we decide whether this bill should move forward or not.
Senator Cruz.
Madam Chairwoman, Senator Anderson, again, you know, I'm going to do the best I can to answer your question. From the residents, businesses, you know, counties, municipalities that I've spoken to, you know, some of them have lived on the river for decades. They've told me stories about how the river has improved, the water quality has improved, their ability to enjoy the river has improved, their ability to use the river as far as businesses has improved. And that's what I go off to make those judgments. So to answer your question, I would say it has been improving. And I think a lot of that has to do with the establishment of the corridor, Governor Cooey's executive order. And I think there was, at that point in time, a very strong effort made. And I think that effort has been successful. And I think where we're at right now is a position with Governor Cooey's executive order where our residents, our counties, our cities, and our businesses can enjoy the river and use the river and have that balance of keeping the river clean and taking care of the river.
Senator Ingebertson.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And there's a lot of discussion here going on about what went on in the policy committee. And again, to Senator Cruz's testimony, we had very extensive testimony, both for and against. Actually, we ran over. My first 15-minute committee ran into about an hour, hour and a half, so we all know what that 15-minute means. But nevertheless, we did put a lot of effort into it. We didn't turn any testifiers down. And the gist of it was the local units of government want that control. The people that live along the river, they request and require the elected officials along that river to take care of the river as the original order showed. And I think the DNR would probably testify that it was very hard to get everybody together to get this new rules situation put together, and it just wasn't happening. And there was a lot of testimony there in fact that this legislation was not needed in the first place. So it was vetted very well. You just need to hear that. I mean, there just was at least, I don't know, I'd probably say 8 or 10 people on either side. So.
Senator Berglund and then Senator Cohen.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm just wondering if there's anyone more objective that could answer Senator Anderson's question about, you know, whether the quality of the river has been declining and what we would lose if we don't have this critical area, these rules go into effect. I think it's only fair that someone more objective than the author of the bill be able to answer the question.
Madam Chair, and to that point, because I was going to ask for some testimony as well, but just and to maybe set the stage for that, and I don't fault Senator Cruz in presenting a bill to this committee, having been told, look, you don't need folks to show up. So I don't blame Senator Cruz in any respect relative to that, but just speaking from the perspective of my city, and I have the entirety of the River Boulevard in St. Paul in my district. Senator Anderson and I are both concerned with the riverfront throughout St. Paul. Obviously, downtown St. Paul's involved. Senator Berglund, you would say the same, I think, relative to Minneapolis. I've not heard from my city whatsoever that they're looking for this. I haven't heard from a single resident of my district that they're looking for this. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard from a single business in St. Paul. My district goes right up to Minneapolis, to the Mississippi River Boulevard on the Minneapolis side, and I haven't heard, so I know a lot of those folks, I haven't heard from those residents, those businesses, and so I don't know if this is a little bit of a solution in search of a problem. If this happens to be a particular problem relative to Senator Cruz's district, in which case maybe it ought to be limited, but relative to Senator Berglund's question, could we have Mr. Clark testify as to what's going on in terms of the river and what's happened with this legislation? Maybe what we passed a couple of years ago isn't necessary. But I'm wondering to follow up on Senator Berglund's question.
Senator Cohen, we have a list of testifiers. Mr. Clark is on the list. And we'll get to him as soon as we have members' questions answered, okay. I guess. Senator Hahn.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I'm just questioning this. I've not been on the Finance Committee previously, but We talk a lot about the process that we have in the Senate and having some respect for that process. It seems to me that there has been a hearing in the policy committee and Senator Ingebrigtsen's committee about the policy implications. Now, I do understand people in this room are not going to agree with the judgment of that committee, but I'm not sure that it is productive to rehear the entire policy argument in this committee. I understand that we did that in the policy committee under Senator Ingebrigtsen, and that there was a vote taken and the bill was passed. And we have it before us as it was passed from that committee. So there was a judgment made on these policy questions by the Senate's policy committee. Now, we, some of us in this room, may not agree with the judgment of that committee. But if we respect the work of that committee, our job is to ask the question whether or not this money that is being proposed in Senator Cruz's bill to be saved by the state is a valid proposal. And I understand the need to understand the bill, but the bill itself is fairly simple. It repeals a law, and the argument is made that there is money to be saved by not implementing the rulemaking any further than that's already been done. That, to me, is a judgment of this committee. And I'm not sure, given the time that we have, that it is productive use of this committee's time to rehear the entire policy argument in this committee.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Cohen, we...
I want to respond to that. Because, Senator Hahn, as I mentioned, there is a fine line as to where we turn the Finance Committee into a policy committee, but it's a bill in front of one of the last major committees. I mean, generally, tax and finance are the last stops for most legislation going to the floor of the Senate. And having chaired this committee for a number of years, but having served with other chairmen of this committee, I can tell you that there has never been an attempt to limit debate in this committee so that members don't know what they're voting on by taking – sure, I mean, let's see, I don't want to save $500,000, apparently, Senator Anderson, from the legacy money, which doesn't go to the general fund anyways, which if we eliminate that money, just goes to the bottom line and stays there, but unless it's re-spent. But – so I can certainly read the legislation as well as anybody, I think, at the table. But what I can't read – is what's behind the legislation. And I'm not aware over the years, and I only served on House Appropriations for a couple of terms, and that was quite a while ago, and I might add served on House Appropriations with a Republican chairman, and the policy discussions in that committee were far-reaching and interesting. So I've never heard anybody try to stop debate in the Finance Committee. It may or may not be appropriate to have amendments that would say, I move to amend to change the entirety of, you know, any state Clean Water Acts. That might not be appropriate without a fiscal attachment. But certainly in terms of a debate, that would be
Senator
a first,
Cohen,
Madam Chair.
I would like to call the testifiers to the table. If we could have Tom Diamond and John Annenson. Come forward. And if Mr. Diamond would like to start, please introduce yourself for the tape.
Thank you. Got some handouts for the committee. Also, Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I would start. I'd like to start off by saying I'd like to thank Senator Ingebrigtsen, who was very courteous and allowed opportunity for everybody to speak at the committee. And you had a good discussion in that committee. But I think it's helpful for you to know a little background to understand whether these financial, what these financial impacts and whether there'll be savings or not. The critical area protects a very important natural resource for the state of Minnesota, very valued asset for our communities. And I'll tell you personally, just for myself, I'm a homeowner, I'm a business owner, I live and I work within the critical area. And the critical area was established 35 years ago. With that was the establishment of the districts, the standards, and the guidelines. So they're all 35 years in place. 20 years ago, you, the legislature, directed the governor to update those guidelines and standards. And has been in legislation since then throughout the adaptations of that code. Over the years, that hasn't happened for various different reasons. So 2 years ago, the legislature took action and directed the DNR to upgrade the rules, guidelines, and standards. provided funding. And I think you should be aware of some of the kinds of things that were driving this desire, besides just updating rules for 35 years old, is communities and individuals felt that the district boundaries, the way the rules are now with executive order, there's no ability for the DNR or anybody to change those district boundaries, even if there's minor alterations that people feel in a community would be beneficial for protecting the resources and providing more opportunities for economic development. There's no provision to allow that to happen. So this would allow that you could make those modifications. Another one of the things is there is only four districts within the critical area. So it's a fairly coarse setup as far as different areas have different needs for both natural resource protection and economic development reasons. And so you can't finely tune it with only four districts. At least that was the belief of many communities and individuals. And so they felt that we should have a wider variety of districts and standards so to meet more closely the needs within the river corridor. So that was another thing. That is not allowed under the current executive order, would not be allowed. So that was one of the things the rulemaking was to look at. Issues like shoreline management was mentioned here. Shoreline management is required throughout the state of Minnesota by state law. It is not implemented. We in St. Paul, for example, do not have a shoreline management a provision, and it is not enforced by the DNR. One of the points of contention in the rulemaking was is to get that addressed one way or another so there's shoreline management within the critical area. Another one of the issues is mapping. This critical area executive order requires that 12 to 18% slopes and 18% and greater slopes be mapped in coordination with the departments, the DNR and Met Council. Because of funding at local levels, this hasn't been completed. So one of the things that the funding did would allow that this mapping get done so that resources available for the management of the corridor, which would save communities a significant amount of money. If you eliminate the rulemaking, you eliminate all these opportunities to address these sorts of issues. The issues won't go away. The flexibility for communities to address those issues is what goes away. And I'll point a real-life example of this that many of you probably are aware of, but certainly Senator Cohen and Senator Anderson are keenly aware of. The Ford plant in St. Paul is in the critical area. The area is designated for redevelopment. This is a very important financial and environmental issue in the city of St. Paul. Right now, it is in what is the Urban Open Space District, and there's a 35-foot height limit on it. Whether that's correct height and correct requirements or not is certainly a point of discussion. The city of St. Paul has been working on that issue, and the task force on the rulemaking looked at that closely. If you take this away, you take away the opportunity to bring current up-to-date planning to that site because we cannot adopt changes to the boundaries of the districts there. We cannot change the designation of the district there. We cannot change heights there. That's just one real-life example of what happens if this goes away. And I think it's really important that we look at what that is. As this legislation was introduced, the legislation was introduced to eliminate the critical area. Now, with the adopt and change, the amendment, it stated that the intent is to keep the critical area just to remove the rulemaking. What I submitted to you, and I won't go into it, but if you actually take a look at if that's actually the intent, which I don't doubt is the intent, to do that, that is not what this legislation does. If you take a look at what is on the books, what is the statutes, and what Mr. Senator Cruz, pardon me, testified here is that he does not see any environmental impact, and all protections today will be there after any action is taken. If you take a look at what is in the books on the statutes, that is not is what in retained in this legislation. Many of these protections, definitions, and authority. An example of that is the EQC was given authority to administer this program in the Critical Area Act. The authority for the DNR to actually administer the program was in statute. It was removed. So the DNR wouldn't have authority under statutes to administer the program. The EQC was. So you'd be switching the program. There are many other provisions as far as the mapping, as far as what is to be protected, were all taken out of this provision. The protection language was all taken out of the statute. That's not tied to the rulemaking. So I would caution that there would not necessarily be the savings. If you take a look at the what is proposed as savings, the $111,000, that was savings from DNR not spending. So whether you take any action or not, that $111,000 would be saved. The $40,000 that is proposed of taking is $40,000 not to hold a public hearing on what these rules are. I would say suggest that that's a poor choice of using money, is to shut down the public hearing process on how you manage this river. The other piece of that that suggested is that there be savings for communities. I can explain how that actually wouldn't work, at least in the case of St. Paul. St. Paul has been working on the critical area, their new zoning, and plus there's been particular plans, for example, like the Ford site plan. In that process, we've been looking at what is going on within the rulemaking. The city of St. Paul, for example, has looked at a new set of districts, doing different district boundaries and different protections, different height regulations and provisions. That is based upon that there be rulemaking authority to do that. The city has gone through that process and is now close to considering those proposals. If this rulemaking goes away, that can't be adopted. That city has to go back to start from scratch and redo their rulemaking process. So at least in the case of the city of St. Paul, it shuts down opportunities to look at other options, makes the city go back and redo this. So I would suggest that there is not the potential savings that are shown in this document, that there are significant environmental impacts that are not foreseen in here. And I thank you very much for your time.
Mr. Diamond, I just have a question. You said that there's a 35-foot height limit for buildings along the river in St. Paul. And I'm trying to figure out, where did that rule come from?
Well, it was really an executive order 130 and Governor Anderson, and then is in executive order 7919 by Governor Cui. It's been on the books for 35 years. It was originally recommended. There were hearings by the Metropolitan Council in 1975, extensive hearings for the whole community, the metropolitan area. They made a recommendation to the governor. They made a recommendation to the EQC, went to the governor. The governor adopted it. It was adopted by the Met Council, made permanent by the Met Council, and it's been in place for 35 years.
So is the only way to change that is to develop a whole new rulemaking process, or could it be done some other way?
There's another way, and that's what this, from what my understanding of how this would work, is this would flip it back to that you'd do it through the executive order, put it back under the executive order, and so the governor would have the authority, which retains an executive order. The catch is, and it could be done that way, but then you go back to, you're starting the process again, and there's likely, or I would hope so, that there's going to be some sort of public process, hearings and stuff. So if we're looking again back on the financial, if what we're doing is looking at how do we save money and how do we protect these resources and provide economic opportunity, we've gone through a lengthy process. Whether you agree or on any particular standard, this is how the process goes, and it's now set to go to hearing. If it has to go back to start a new process, either an executive order or some other configuration, then we just start the clock ticking and the money spending again. And I'm not sure that serves financially, and I'm not sure it serves communities like St. Paul or other communities where we have sites like the Ford plant site, which it really would be helpful to get figured out what are the parameters of redevelopment and how we best protect the natural resources during that development. So that's why I raise that question, is the financial impacts of that.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you. Thank you for that, Mr. Diamond.
You're welcome, sir.
Do you have an idea of the local units of governments along this corridor have shoreland rules now? And if they do, did they not have a public process during that rulemaking process themselves?
Senator Ingebrigtsen, Chair, I'm not familiar with all the communities' shoreland energy rules. Some of them do have adopted them, but some have not adopted them. And the DNR has not enforced them, though there's a requirement to have shoreland management. They have not enforced that in St. Paul, though some of us have called and encouraged them to actually implement it.
This impacts how that is managed, as you're well aware. Part of the discussion in the critical area, or the rulemaking process, was how do we get this resolved? Is this either going to get built into those rules, or is the DNR going to implement the requirements that are in the legislation? That was one of the things that we were trying to get addressed, but we're waiting on.
Senator Engelbert.
Follow up on, and Madam Chair, I don't know if the, and maybe Senator Cruz could talk to this, but there's a deadline on this particular rulemaking designation for the DNR. That was up in January 4th, so these rules are not in effect and can't be put into effect unless they're actually put into law. So the function of the DNR, and for whatever reason, and I think most of the testimony was it was real hard to get them together, real hard to get folks together to come together and organize these public meetings, because there was a lot, quite frankly, a lot of pushback from local units of government and those folks who want to retain local control. So I don't know if the group knows that or not, or if the committee knows that.
Senator Cruz, did you want to comment on that?
Sure, just a little bit, Madam Chairwoman and Senator Ingebrigtsen. Yeah, you are correct. A lot of, at least from what I heard, the rationale behind that was that there was such significant pushback that they weren't able to come to terms on what the reasonable drafting of the rules would look like. And I'd also like to speak a little bit to the general principles here. And we have local units of government in place that are capable, under current legislation, of enacting rules. I think if we want to address any area here, I think we should address enforcement. And I think we heard this repeatedly in the testimony, again, when we were in the Environment Committee, that the problem is that the current rules in place maybe weren't being enforced in certain locations. To me, that seems like that's a completely different scenario than creating a whole set, a new set of rules. If we want to talk about enforcement, let's talk about that. But that's, that's what I heard.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This, I think, it raises some broader issues. I've heard several comments that we've passed statutes and they weren't being implemented, so now we're going to have rules. So therefore, rules have more power and authority in law than our statutes do. I was working on an issue where there were some folks that were involved in a rulemaking process and had announced in this form of the task force that rules trump the law. And I say, no, statutes, are what we do here is, if anything, it's to direct where there is some sense of implementation of it that rules are needed. And cities have ordinances. They don't pass rules. They have ordinances that have to be within the framework and consistency with the authority that's given them by statute. So it kind of concerns me if we are saying, well, couldn't do it by statute, so we're going to turn it over to another body to create rules. We've had arguments over the years over this in terms of how rulemaking is used and the extensiveness, because it can have a broad reach. And sometimes maybe it's legislators that are not willing to grapple with an issue and then just turn it over to a bureaucracy to go through a rulemaking process, or even expedite in some cases and actually end up with things that have the force and effect of law. So that part is kind of concerning me about this, whether it's the shoreline or what it is. And I think that needs some attention in terms of if the executive order has that power and can't be changed, but I think it can. I think the legislature can still pass laws, which, of course, have to be signed by the governor, the executive branch. We ought to be looking at some of these key areas and determining whether the elements of them that are needed for change ought not to be done in statute and not necessarily relying on the rulemaking. Because what happens a lot of times in the rulemaking is the authority is the authority that is granted makes some of our citizens feel helpless in terms of what they can, in fact, do or how to deal with it. And we, it's, you know, that's in a couple of books over there that we don't pay a lot of attention to, and we just let that ride on. And I think it's irresponsible on our part not to be paying more attention to what is good policy, belongs in statute, rather than becoming over-reliant on rules to actually carry out the laws.
Members, the Commerce Committee moves in here at 10:30, and so I'd like to move on to our next testifier, Mr. Anstenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Anstenson. I am the Chief of the Resource Management Division for the Mississippi National River and Recreation Area, one of 394 units of the National Park System. Our superintendent is in Florida. He regrets not being able to be here. As you've heard, we spent about $350,000, the state has, on this process so far. The National Park Service has spent hundreds of hours on this process so far. Were the funding and the time wasted is one question. And I don't believe they were, as long as the process is allowed to continue. If it's not allowed to continue, you might argue the money has been wasted. But I would argue it has not been misspent. This money has been used, and the time has been used to get something that we desperately need, which is sound protection for the resources Congress and the state of Minnesota recognized were critical in the 72-mile critical area. When the state of Minnesota established the critical area, it said there was something really special about this 72 miles. When the National Park Service created a unit of its national park system, something it doesn't do easily along this 72 miles, it said there was something very special about this 72-mile corridor. Governor Carlson and Secretary Babbitt approved our comprehensive management plan here. And when they did that, they did it after extensive state, local, and private involvement. In doing so, they acknowledged that the National Park Service could have been given a stronger hand in management of this corridor, but they said, no, let's leave it to the local authorities, the state agencies, and local governments. Let them do it. And the comprehensive management plan was essentially the promise from the state that would happen. Unfortunately, the critical area executive order hasn't done that, and it's the key to the protections that we need. It's not protecting the resources well enough. It has proven too vague. Over the years and during the meetings on the rulemaking, we found out that they need developers and the cities need more certainty. They need more clarity, probably less subjectivity. Bad developments can hurt neighborhoods and communities, and they can cost the state and local communities lots of money. Some rules are controversial. We know that. Some, most, in fact, are not. In fact, as Tom mentioned, there is more flexibility in what you would see in the new rules. For those who don't agree, the rulemaking process provides an opportunity to sit down and talk about the rules. Are they overreaching? Do they impose an unjustifiable burden? These are issues that the people can come and testify on before the administrative law judge. So the National Park Service believes that the money spent to date has been a sound investment of the state's money, and the return will be substantial if the process continues. If not the qualities that made the 72-mile corridor so significant and so significant to the state, will decline, and the quality of life along the river with it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Anstenson. We're going to take our next testifiers. We'd like to wrap up this bill today. The Friends of the Mississippi, Irene Jones, Whitney Clark, and Lynn Moretzka.
Madam Chair, could I quickly respond to Senator Olson?
Maybe you.
I'll do it later.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Whitney Clark. I'm Executive Director of Friends of the Mississippi River. We're a St. Paul-based nonprofit organization with the purpose of protecting and enhancing the Mississippi River in the Twin Cities area. I'm here today representing our 1,700 members, more than 3,000 annual volunteers, and hundreds of event participants who view this river not only as an internationally significant natural resource, but also their local treasure. In your packet today, you should have a letter signed by 39 conservation and environmental organizations organized under the Minnesota Environmental Partnership, urging you to oppose Senate File 39. Friends of the Mississippi River was actively engaged in helping pass the 2009 amendments to 116G that Senate File 39 would now repeal. As a reminder, the 2009 amendments were the result of many years of discussion and study among river stakeholders about how to best protect this shared asset, this great Mississippi River corridor. The amendment passed with bipartisan support in the legislature, a $500,000 appropriation that, as Senator Anderson noted, was signed by Governor Paul Lente. As we've noted today, to date, approximately $350,000 of that appropriation of the Legacy Amendment Clean Water Fund has been spent by the DNR over the past 19 months carrying out the direction provided in 116G. They've been gathering natural resource data and information, meeting with all of the affected local governments, convening stakeholder groups from throughout the corridor, holding public open houses throughout the corridor, reading and responding to comments from stakeholders, developing the preliminary draft standards, and writing the statement of need and reasonableness that Mr. Amphenson just referred to. This work is very nearly completed, and the DNR stated in Senator Ingebrigtsen's committee, the Environment Committee, that they would like a small amount of time, additional time, to finish their work. In addition to the DNR staff resources, thousands of stakeholder hours have been expended participating in the process to develop this set of very common sense rules to facilitate and manage very diverse set of stakeholders and sometimes conflicting uses of the river. If this bill becomes law, all of this work and effort, and not to mention $350,000 of the Legacy Amendment funds, which were approved by 1.6 million Minnesotans, which are constitutionally dedicated to protecting Minnesota's natural environment and clean water, will have been wasted, deliberately wasted. The Mississippi River Corridor Critical Area.
Senator Olson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, sir, I think you just made a statement that's kind of interesting. The time frame has run out, that the legal time frame for drafting those rules. So, in other words, there has to be some affirmative action by the legislature for them to go forward. So if this bill doesn't pass, the rulemaking has still stopped.
That, Madam Chair.
I mean, this bill has nothing to do with that. Without an affirmative action, this process would not go forward. Is that an accurate statement?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I'm not sure if that is. There's some legal question about whether the DNR would have general authority to proceed if this legislation
Senator
were not
Senator Olson,
Mr. Knopf, can you answer that question? I know we've had that with other rulemaking processes.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, Mr. Bodden might have the statute in front of him. I did have it on my phone here, though. basically, with the statute, it's 18 months from when the rules are either authorized or mandated. You have an 18-month period, and if they miss that period, the rulemaking cannot proceed without further action by the legislature, and including they can't go back to any underlying rulemaking authority that they have to also do. If they have underlying rulemaking authority, that would also they're completely stopped. Okay. The way I read the statute, Mr. Bodden may have other comments about it. This is not in my purview, but I do know that the statute exists and. Sure. It is a problem for some of these rulemaking.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Olson.
Mr. Bodden, I apologize for bypassing you on this question.
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I think Mr. Knopf is exactly right, and that is a relatively recent statute. I don't have the site right at my fingertips, but in essence, it's they have to commence with the new authority within that time frame. And I don't know if it's also related to, if you look on the section that's being repealed on the back page, there is a statement there that the very last sentence on the bottom of that page says, by January 15th, 2010, the commissioner shall begin the rulemaking required by this section under Chapter 14. That might be open to some interpretation. and I'm not sure exactly where this particular rulemaking process is. It doesn't sound like any notices have been filed, and whether that would be sufficient is also an open question.
So it seems to me, I understand that if we vote for Senator Cruz's bill today or not, it doesn't, it won't hurt because it probably would be expiring anyway. And we are running out of time. Ms. Jones, could I give you about 30 seconds?
I'm Lynn Moratzka, and I'll speak very quickly on the economic issue. I'm a resident of the city of Hastings and a former MNRA commissioner. I was on the commission when the comprehensive management plan was passed and appointed by Governor Carlson to be that appointee for the city of Hastings. From my perspective, repealing this law does not make any economic sense. First of all, the critical area rulemaking process is near completion, and most of the $500,000 appropriation has been spent to update and modernize the 35-year-old standards and guidelines. To quit right before the finish line would be essentially throwing away $500,000, which you have heard, on the work on behalf of the river, our region, and the state. People may have issues with the rules. And that's the part of this whole thing, is to get people engaged in the process, engaged in the rulemaking process, so that we can work these issues out. Furthermore, the city of Hastings gets a lot of economic benefits from a healthy Mississippi River. I'm a former city council member. I served on Hastings City Council for 12 years. The river is one of the big reasons why people choose to live, work, and recreate in Hastings. Many of the city's plans are focused on expanding the park and recreation opportunities along the river and improving and protecting water quality. We have three marinas within our corporate city limits. This is a very recreating along the river, the access, we have a large DNR public landing there. What happens upriver impacts us significantly downriver. State rules for the river corridor will help protect these important assets that our community depends upon. If this law is repealed and we don't get new rules for the river, Hastings is likely to be harmed the most in this corridor. We are downstream of the 72-mile critical area, so if our upstream neighbors do not adequately protect shorelines, bluffs, and water quality, it could negatively impact the health of the Mississippi River in our community and those south of us. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. Moratzka. We are out of time. The committee is ready to move in. Senator Anderson, to the fiscal impact of
Madam
the
Chair,
bill.
Just briefly, I just want to say on the record that it's not clear whether the DNR's rulemaking authority would expire if we don't pass this bill. And I don't want to leave the impression, as you suggested, that it's decided. I think there's some discussion with the Attorney General's office about this, and as Mr. Bodern correctly pointed out, there's some possible different interpretations of different statutes. So I don't think we have an answer in front of us that is clear, and that's why lawyers get paid a lot of money to discuss who has the right legal interpretation of the statutes. And so I just want to be clear that we don't have a clear answer on that issue.
Well, Senator Anderson, this body right now, the legislature, has the opportunity to supersede whatever is in current statute with the change in statute. And so if there is a desire of this committee to pass this bill, we will move forward with it, and we need a motion. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Real quickly, in light of the fact that we've had testimony now with regards to the financial aspects of this and probably a little more than policy than what we really needed, I don't think it's bad to have that. However, I've yet to have any legislator, and I can't speak for Senator Cruz, that has come forth to say, well, we need to enact another statute here to move this forward to finish the process. In light of that fact, I would move Senate File 39 and recommend it to pass.
Senator Ingebrigtsen moves that Senate File 39 be recommended to pass. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed?
No.
No.
Motion does pass. And the meeting is adjourned.